Okay, and it's five, four, three, two, one.
Hey, welcome to Tell the Damn Story with the legend himself, ladies and gentlemen, someone who has written for everybody, from Batman to Scooby-Doo, from Long Ranger to
Tarzan.
Who was that? The Archie guy.
Oh, yeah, that too.
And
yeah,
the creator of Aaron Blackjack Day, the 1930s African-American soldier of fortune, legend, almost equal to the writer himself, Alex Simmons. Hello, Alex Simmons. How are you?
I am fine, Chris. Thank you for that wonderful build-up.
And I've actually
yet to do the Lone Ranger, but I'm working on it.
I'm trying to think positive. Yeah,
but now I got my partner here, Chris Ryan, who has done 1,001 things that he's not going to talk about. So I have to. But the big thing we're going to do today, because we got so many people here, is we're going to talk about your not only your writing, but your publishing effort here. Your major publishing effort.
My 2023 obsession.
And
there
these people here are going to help us see how big it is. Okay.
So we have four special guests today, all of whom were generous enough to participate in a grand experiment called Soul Scream Anthologine, part magazine, part anthology, and a celebration of hybrid horror. One of the things I love most about horror is that it just opens its arms to every other genre. It is the most flexible of literary areas to write in, and it accepts everybody. And today we're going to get a wide array of different styles, different hybrids that will show us exactly how rich horror is. And to help me do that today, besides the legendary Alex Simmons, is Rebecca Cuthbert, Johnny Gensler, Kathleen Shiner, and SVP, Stephen Van Patten. All right. If we can go really quickly with the introductions, and then I want to start to hear from your writing. Rebecca, you are what I would say up and coming writer, emerging everywhere. Poetry, short story, dark horror comedy. How else can I describe you?
I'm really good at making pickles, Chris, so we'll add that to the list.
She is really good at making pickles. I've tasted the pickles, yes.
That is fantastic. Yeah, Rebecca's very good at social media, and we see a lot of this. I'm working on this writing, I'm working on that writing, and then there's jars of jam or preserved peaches or pickles. It's just this wide array of stuff going on at Rebecca Cuthbert's.
She serves up tasty treats, literary and otherwise. Fun. Okay. Yes.
And speaking of tasty treats, here's Jonathan Gensler.
Thank you, John.
You're welcome, sir. John, you've had a lot of different experiences. Give us a few.
I grew up in West Virginia in a haunted house. I was an officer in the Army for 5 years during the first several years of a post 9/11 era. I worked in clean tech for about 15 years. And then after my father passed a couple years ago, I wound down my business to focus on writing and processing my grief. And that's how I got to where I am today. Writing.
There you go. Fantastic. Kathleen Shiner, can you give us a little, I know that's that group that I admire that you work with, but tell us about that. Tell us about a few other things that is Kathleen Shiner.
Okay. I work with an organization called Girls Right Now. We're professional female writers, partner with mentees in the New York City area from underserved neighborhoods that don't really have access to an arts program. And we work with them on writing. By the end of the year, they have a portfolio of about 6 professional pieces. They do a reading, a live reading in front of a large audience, hundreds of people. And 100% of our mentees go on to college.
That's fantastic.
Very cool.
And in your spare time, you get some horror writing in every once in a while?
Yes, I do. I love writing horror. My genre of choice is body horror. And my day job, I work as a medical editor, so I hear about all the terrible things that can happen to your body, which informs my work quite well.
That's fantastic. All right, Stephen Van Patten. Top that.
I can't really. So basically, my log line about myself is that I am a stage manager by day, horror writer by night. So what that means is any given day, I'm either at ABC stage managing Tamara Hall show or CBS or any pretty much any place where they shoot television in the tri-state area. But at night, after a couple of glasses of wine, I sit down and I write scary stuff, including my vampire trilogy, which is about to have a part four sometime next year. That's Brookwater's Curse, Killer Genius, hyper-intelligent Black woman who becomes socially conscious serial killer. There's a series that I do with my podcast mates, Mark Abbott, Kirk Johnson, and now Denise Tapscott will be in the third bit. I just released a anthology entitled SVP's Little Black Book of Terror, where I got a bunch of my horror writer friends together to donate stories. The proceeds and the sales of that particular book will be going to Suicide Awareness Voices of Education, which is, as you might be able to guess, a suicide prevention organization.
Fantastic.
Yes, that's enough.
And could you drop the name of your podcast, please?
Oh, the name of the podcast is Beef, Wine, and Shenanigans. It started off as myself, Mark, and Kirk just basically breaking down horror movies and nerd culture and stuff like that. And then the country got turned on its ear politically. So every once in a while, we vent about certain political figures. And then Denise Tapscott joins us post-COVID and from California. So
that's fantastic.
It's so fun. They wear themed outfits when they go out.
Oh, and then
I've seen those.
Yes. And I think it was Denver. You came out. Everybody was just knocked out by the
Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh. They came out in all white outfits.
Yes, it was Pittsburgh. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Is that like your all white album?
Yeah.
The joke has already been made, like the few pictures that are out with the four of us all decked out. That's the album cover, or that's this. So
it was so fun.
So we can see how diverse the backgrounds of horror writers are, and living in informs the writing. So everybody who's watching, strap in, because we're going to go on a bit of a ride. And the first thing we're going to do is let Rebecca have the wheel. And Rebecca, you want to take it from here?
Sure. Okay, so I'm going to be reading, got my nice shiny copy here, my small screen. And I'm going to read a little bit from my story, The Quilting Circle of Bygone Gardens. And I am going to read the beginning, but then I'm going to skip a little bit. I'll fill you in and then read my favorite scene.
All right.
Marge scowled across the dining room at her nemesis, Stella Bianchi. Stella sat with four other residents at the corner table telling some stupid story or other about her dough-faced grandchildren, waving her fat hands to show off the rings her dead husband bought her that probably weren't real anyway. Stella made Marge want to puke, strutting around like a has-been prom queen and making eyes at the male nurses, like they'd ever be interested in hanky-panky with a carcass. No, the next time Stella got nailed, it would be into her coffin. Ha! Marge laughed out loud at the joke she made in her head. No one looked at her, though. She sat alone at a two-person table near the doors to the kitchen, eating thin minestrone soup and potato bread rolls. Folks talked to themselves all the time here, to themselves or ghosts or memories no one else could see. Stella caught Marge watching her and smiled like a cat hoarding all the cream. Marge flicked her off. All right, gonna fast forward a little bit. Marge has made friends with a new person who she calls a part-timer because Charisse is there for rehab. She's not gonna be a resident. Reluctantly makes friends because she doesn't really have any. There are some troubling stories of abuse at this nursing home, and Charisse and Marge team up and they form a quilting circle that gets into more than quilting. I'm going to give too much away, but they need more than two people. Marge has to make the tough decision about who to invite. And she decides that awful is better than boring, so she's going to invite Stella. A few hours later, Marge cornered Stella near the three shelves of dog-eared paperbacks the home called the library. Stella had a copy of Eat, Pray, Love tucked under her arm. Of course she did. Marge, Stella said. Stella. Stella sniffed and fluffed her already fluffy hair. Marge almost backed out. Good Christ, did she hate Stella. But she needed her. She took a deep breath and stood straight as her curving spine would allow. I wanted to ask you something. Ooh, is it a favor? Do you want to owe me, Marjorie? Marge narrowed her eyes. Fat chance. I'm here to offer you an opportunity. Ha, like you could. What for? A quilting circle. Membership by invitation only. Why would I want to join your quilting circle? Because you have nothing better to do? Do to. Do not. Fine. But only if I can bring Marcus. Who's Marcus? Marge tried to remember which idiot sat with Stella at mealtimes. The handsome one who's always next to me? Don't play dumb. I've seen the jealousy on your face. Marge snickered. What you saw was probably me passing wind, you ninny. Can I? Can you what? Bring Marcus? Does he sew? He's a good dancer. Marge rolled her eyes to the water-stained ceiling tiles. And that's important. Why? A man who can dance is always important. Marge thought again of how much she hated Stella, but also how much she hated boring people. And everyone else at Bygone Gardens was boring. Ugh, she conceded. Fine. Then it's fine for me too. 8 tonight in the media room. Stella narrowed her eyes. Why so late? Worried about your beauty sleep? Don't be. It would take at least a coma to improve your looks. And you must get no sleep at all, poor thing. Up all night like the bat you are? Is that why I can detect your bullshit from a mile away? Careful, Marjorie. Vulgarity is a sign of dementia. Maybe you're right. I'm beginning to forget why I invited you. I'll remind you tonight at 8 with Marcus. Marge gave the other woman an up and down. Stella gave her one back. Marge. Stella walked away, her recently acquired hip giving her a jaunty gait. Marge scowled at her back, then went to her room to find her old sewing supplies. That's where I'll stop.
Right, there you go.
I love this story.
Yeah, I do too. Marge and Stella are just fantastic. The thing about Rebecca is that whatever she writes, the voice is authentic. And I don't know how she got authentically ancient, but it really works. And when the horror elements kick in, it doesn't, the comedy doesn't suffer. So this was our entry into comedic folk magic or folklore and horror mix. Rebecca, can you talk to us briefly about how the quilting circle came together?
Sure. So one is that I do love older people. I think that they're super interesting. I think that they don't get enough screen time anywhere. My dad's in his 80s. And he's a hoot. I worked for our local newspaper for a while as a reporter, and we live in an aging community. So I was actually writing stories on things like knitting circles and fundraisers and all the sort of small town things that some people think are boring, but are like rife with politics and drama.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all that. And then there's just that I wanted to capture the fun frenemy spirit of that we see on the Golden Girls.
Mm.
That sort of groundbreaking, hey, these people are older, they're not teenagers, but they're so fun.
Yeah.
And I just thought the idea of senior citizen care home frenemies was hilarious. And I had taken a class on witchcraft. And so I had the folk magic in my head. It's a very American tradition. I didn't want to step on the toes of another culture. So I just went to American folklore and how it's for everybody. And I'm a crafty lady. I don't sew. I garden and I cook. So it's like I just combined all my favorite things. And I really love horror comedy.
Yeah, it was fun. I remember you described it as Golden Girls meets Abbott Costello meets folk magic. And it was a very apt description, right? That's fantastic. We're going to come back as a group discussion a little later, and then we'll hear more from Rebecca. Jonathan Gensler, it's your time, sir.
My time.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to read from Reap What You Sow, which is the opening story of Science Runs Amok.
Yes.
The most recent volume of Soul Scream Anthology. I'm going to read the opening sequence.
Cool.
Mac Adams walked through ankle-deep black dust, rubber waders to his knees, face carved with fine lines from decades under the Nebraska sun. Every 20 or so paces, he'd straighten up and kneel and hammer a metal stake into the hard, dry ground. These stakes are the key to keeping the pilot land secure. That's what the company man from North Central Agronomics had told him. They'll signal the boundary of the phase one pilots to the Omni Combine before we open the program to the whole farm in phase two. That meant the farmer had to plot out there and mark the land himself. We need to secure the pilot from the rest of your land, and especially the other farms around. It isn't too different from what you might be used to with the seed varieties from the competition. We'll need to keep a buffer of at least a half a mile between the pilot and the surrounding acreage. Cross-pollination could result in unwelcome legal attention, and I know you and your neighbors don't need that. Max stopped to place his hand on his lower back, bending backward so his eyes faced the endless blue skies above. Neighbors. What neighbors? I guess he didn't do too much research. We need to see the results first. But if it goes well, there could be a very big payday in it for you and for Silent Meadows Farm. The promise from North Central was the root of his daughter Demi's argument. There's no such thing, and you know it, Pop. Free seed, free lunch, free nothing. She'd been here that day, of course. Talked through the details with a company man. She'd been the brains of the farm after Norm had passed. She'd skittered away back home from the left coast, at least for a few years. I know guys like this, Pop, and they are not concerned about the land. They're not concerned about the people. They're straight out of Silicon Valley, and I tell you, they aren't like us. What do you even know about North Central Agronomics? Do you know where the tech comes from? Why? How it's supposed to work? He told us both about it. It's not gene-based, not another modified version of the same old variants. Something else, he said. Nano something. It helps the seeds find the nutrition they need, even when it's scarce. Sounded about perfect for what we have out here. God. Even has a nano protect mode to shield it from threats. Exactly. You don't understand it. I don't understand it. And that company man, Mr. James, he didn't sound like he understood it all that much either. And that makes it too damned risky. Her hackles were raised, and the disappointed father in him knew she was about to cut and run. What else am I supposed to do, Dam? He laid their finances bare to her the previous winter. Too many bills coming due. Too many years of hit and miss weather. Too much rain and not enough. Fertilizer prices all over the place, but mostly up and up, especially since the war in Russia wasn't slowing down. If I want to keep this land, if you want to keep this land, then we need to sign on that dotted line. Charlie, down the hefty seed, He told me our credits run dry and nothing he can do for us this year. If I don't get this new seed in and pull that corn out of the ground, then everything is gone. Maybe that'd be for the best, Pop. The land has gone sour. Your mind seems to be going with it. I told you the Great Plains Conservation Society can put the land in trust. Give us a little something to live on. You know this, and yet you won't. Demi, you know I can't, and you know why. They're part of the reason we're where we are. They'd gotten off our asses about the water tables, we'd been just fine. Those lefties are as bad as the vultures from Silicon Valley. And I'm going to go with the ones who want to keep this land productive, who might just save our farm. At what cost, Pop? The payday is coming, one way or the other, sissy. One way or the other. And at that, she stormed off.
John, you were talking in your introduction about having done clean tech. And I love that you just drop a little bit of tech language in this opening. Just enough for us to wait a minute.
Start to smell the possibilities of this.
Uh-oh.
It's never good when they experiment.
Yeah, it would have been very easy to drop the hammer and overdo that. And the light touch was so wonderful in getting us involved in the farmer's point of view and his daughter trying to talk her sense into him and the company man, as he's described. So you have three very different point of view, and but just starts out as it sounds like they're sitting around the kitchen table. Just with the tech guy, it feels like he's out in the farm. But between the father and daughter, it's just sitting. And that may be the last moment in that story where things are calm.
It goes sideways from there.
Yeah, in a really wonderful way.
Pretty quickly.
What was your inspiration
for this one in particular? And I grew up in a semi-rural environment in southern West Virginia. Had a lot of friends. I'd go stay the night on friends who had farms, cows and corn. And then when I was in the Army, I grew to have a lot of friends who grew up in much more rural places than I do. I think I Tuckerized a good friend of mine who is a farmer in North Dakota. And I went to his wedding in Fargo, which is in the middle of a million square miles of farms. So that I know those places and those people pretty well. But you know, I went to MIT for grad school. I worked with big tech for a long time, worked in big tech, worked with a couple of Silicon Valley firms. And I feel like I know that too. And the notion of an urban-rural divide in our country is a cultural flashpoint and has been for the last several years. And I wanted to explore that because I've been part of both of those worlds. And so I wanted to bring this clash of kind of big tech and big agriculture and smash them together in this family. and then center it at this family that has been let down by all sides. They've been let down by the tech firms. They've been let down by the ag firms. They've been let down by their local banks. Everyone has let this family down, and they're letting each other down, and they can't come to grips with it. And so that was just trying to process this cultural moment that we've been in.
It developed a two-tier horror for me. Mm-hmm. And I noticed this when I heard the story first or read the story first in Authorcon. It's the farming and the tech, but also it's the drowning of American spirit. Like you said, everybody letting the core people down. And that added a whole different level of horror that I really appreciated. So thank you for that. It was really exciting. Thanks. That I didn't know if I was going to get this story. And I was dangling on the line for a while, but then John came through. All right, John, we'll talk to you in a little bit.
I just wanted to quickly say that an aspect that I appreciate is for years, and this is me going back in my time machine, for years, this sort of a conflict was usually chemical companies and farmers. And so it's interesting to see it approach now from this tech world, because that's where we're going. We're so inundated with tech now and AI and all that. It's interesting. It's another vision or another view or another angle to look at this. So I found that very intriguing. I'm going to stop now.
Was great. Yeah. And mm-hmm. that the horror doesn't stop just because we have a new innovation.
That's right.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to talk to Kathleen Shiner here for a couple minutes. You're another one. I really wanted to get a story from you. And I wasn't sure if I had sold it well. And then, you were so nonchalant on the entire, I have to get it. I'm not sure if it's ready. And then, really?
It's something I've been playing with for a long time.
And then you sent me this thing. Yeah. And the creeping horror of this story is delicious.
Oh,
ladies and gentlemen, we're going to hand the reins over to Kathleen Shiner.
Thank you. I'm going to be reading from Hairs.
And that's
my roommate horror story.
There you go. Yep.
I noticed right away that Clara didn't clean up after herself very well. Everything was fine in the kitchen. She might have a used glass in the sink or maybe a small plate. But there were never piles of dirty pots and pans or milk sitting around in mugs with a curdle on top. No, it was in the bathroom where her hygiene was deplorable. Clara constantly shed long black hairs. Every time I used the bathroom, I found them in the sink or on the toilet seat. They also littered the tiled floor, accumulating into drifts like black hair mats. I cleaned the hairs out of the bathtub's drain every time I took a shower. But otherwise, I left them alone. Still, those hairs clung to me. I found them everywhere when I least expected it. One night, I was at the office late working on invoicing. Most of the employees had left, and I was alone at my workplace with just the buzz of fluorescent lights and the magical ding my computer would make every time I hit save or got a new email. Something brushed against my face, and all of my nerve endings jumped on high alert. A creepy, crawly sensation making my body break out in goose flesh. There was an odor of smoke, like from a campfire. Though afraid to check, I finally reached back near my shoulder and found a hair brushing against me. It seemed to be coming from my sweater, woven in tight with material, but not thick like the green wool of the yarn. No, this was the smooth but annoying touch of a wisp of hair. It waved against my face with the whoosh of the heat coming on through the ventilation system. I grabbed it and pulled. The hair was long, about 2 feet, when I finally extricated it from my sweater. I put it down on my desktop and realized it was one of Clara's black, witchy hairs. It seemed to twist and turn on its own like a living thing, and I pushed myself away in my wheelie chair. Unable to take its dance anymore, I wadded it up into a yellow post-it and threw it in the trash, repulsed. My body shivered as I imagined more of her black hairs on me. At home with Clara, I was never completely alone. I expected my roommate to go out occasionally, for a job or to grocery shop or to a movie, something like that, but not Clara. She always stayed in the apartment, and not in an innocuous way, like sitting in her bedroom, reading a book or playing on the computer. She was always building something, hammering, nailing, or sewing on a loud sewing machine. Her art, I guessed. She spent a lot of time in the bathroom while a rush of water sounded out from behind the closed door. Otherwise, Clara laid out on the yellow velvet couch in the hallway that served as our living room, gazing up and around at her strange paintings. I started to notice a smell to the common areas, an odor like meat gone bad that lingered no matter how often I took down the garbage. Often I'd find that the paintings on the walls had been rearranged, and it creeped me out that I couldn't predict where the tentacle paintings would be. Going to pee during the darkest hours of the night, I'd flinch when something hard like a thumb poked me out of the way of the bathroom before I realized that Clara had moved her paintings again, and I'd run into one of the projections. Her artwork scared me.
There you go. Let's do some of this. Yes. And I can just tell everybody that It gets creepier from there.
I'm thinking move.
Yeah, in the story, it's like word,
am I fool?
Yeah. You know how hard it is to get an apartment at a decent, I don't know, decent
street,
price.
Then park, cardboard box, move.
Yeah, sometimes so, those good deals are not such good deals.
That's right. Always be suspicious of a really good deal.
Yeah,
Kathleen, what are the origins of this story?
I would say I get most of my things out of my journal. So like stories that I hear from people watching, and also like hair can be really repulsive. I can remember times in the subway and somebody's long hair falls. It is just a creepy sensation. Just get it away from me. It's dirty. But then also I had a friend telling me, we're all comparing like bad roommate stories. I think everybody in New York has one. Sure. So somebody was talking about, it's like, yeah, I got this room. It was really cheap, but the rule was I couldn't move the artwork in there. And one day I moved it. That's my bedroom. And the person was going in. It was just like, you moved the artwork. So that was the origin. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Your style is very subtle.
Is it?
Yeah. There's not a bolt of lightning that comes in or a bucket of blood, at least not in this story, right?
No.
Yeah, you might have buckets elsewhere.
I build up to it. I like to creep like cats. Yeah. You know?
Where did that come from? What influences fed that interest?
The slow buildup?
Yeah, the slow buildup. Yeah.
Yeah. Just what I like. I just really love a gothic atmosphere, and I like building it. I'm a Taurus, so I'm like all about like tactile, physical things. And
there you go.
Really like writing those descriptions. Yeah.
Yeah, it really works a lot. So we're going to talk again in a little bit.
Cool.
We've gone through three different areas of Americana, American life, and all that. But Stephen's going to take us the furthest into America, Central America, Aztec America. Stephen Van Patten, you have the wheel, sir.
Oh, thank you. And so this is going to be...
This is you, right?
Yeah.
I'm You're listening. In Monstrous Hearts. Yeah.
Oh, wait.
Are you golden?
Yes. So real quick, I apologize ahead of time because some of these Aztec names and words and stuff like that, like I actually rehearsed it with YouTube, but of course I don't have the benefit of being able to remember the stuff exactly, but I think I got it. But anyway, I'm going to pick it up in this one quick little section in which you find out how Aztecs handle enemies that they've captured on their All land.
Right. Oh, dear.
Kathleen's, the name of Kathleen's story was Hares. What is the name of your story before we...
Oh, the Eagle and the Jaguar.
There we go. Thank you.
And so here's the excerpt. Normally, I conduct these rituals with whole-bodied participants. Can you tell me why you cut out their tongues? Coatl was standing behind the high priest Atl as he prepared the altar for the sacrifices to come. They put up a fearsome fight. After the battle, I was so enraged I lost myself. I decided that I needed to punish them. After they were subdued, "That's not our way, Coatl," the high priest Atl stopped, sharpening his obsidian blades and turned to face him. "They can't talk. They couldn't take on the coat of Zepe Totec, the flayed lord. As miserable as they are, we couldn't force them to participate in our festival. We could not give them the drink, nor the women they would customarily receive. We are doing this now to put them out of their misery. I can't even sacrifice one of them to Tlaloc as I normally would. I can't afford risking the rain god being offended, lest we all suffer through a dry harvest." Coatl cast a guilty gaze toward the neglected north side of the pyramid roof, where the altar for Tlaloc sacrifices would go unused this day. "I am so sorry, High Priest." He clasped his hands in front of him. "I don't know what happened. I just got carried away." From under an ornate headdress, High Priest Atl scowled as a theory formed in his mind. "Was that your plan all along? To bring these two in injured so that I would be forced to execute them early for the sake of mercy and you would be hastened to the equal status of Talaka. No, High Priest, I would never do such a thing. High Priest Awful cast a look at the two men standing silently on the other side of the temple. He sighed loudly, a rare show of annoyance. These two really should have been given a proper send-off. He admired the fact that they seemed conformed to their sacrificial duties, even though they'd been cheated. Even though their hearts would be removed from their chests in little more than an hour, the captives believed that they were doing the right thing. Dying is what happens when behind enemy lines when you're captured. If the roles had been reversed, it would be their high priest preparing the other two men, and they would be expected to carry themselves in the same stoic manner. This was the natural order of things when your tribe and your enemies worship and ultimately feed the same god. I will pray to Huitzilopochtli. He is a war god. He will forgive us for the missing tongues. The high priest returned to sharpening his obsidian blades he would be using on the captives. I will pray for forgiveness as well, Kowalto blurted. He knew all too well that forgiveness was needed. Finish getting them ready, High Priest Alto instructed. I hear the others coming. And I'll stop there.
There you go. Yes, do some of this, please. There you go. Now, my impression of Steven is successful city man about town. So how did we decide to go back to Aztec culture?
It was actually, so first, I should point out, this story was written a long time ago when someone, basically what happened is someone was putting together a mummy anthology. They contacted me. They didn't want all of the mummy stories to be Egypt and Imhotep and all that stuff. So I said, all right, I'll do a deep dive into Aztec culture. And what you get from what I just read is just a basic part of the setup, because what it really turns into is a kind of a brother versus brother-in-law rivalry thing that kind of centers around the also the fact that there is a warring tribe a few miles away. And that was what I came up with. Excuse me. And then the anthology went away. So now I'm just sitting with this mummy story that I actually worked hard on. And it sat for years until, and then I actually tried it somewhere else. But then the note that I got, that I received rather, when after I submitted the story was that, well, first they wanted to know my ethnicity. And when I said, oh, African-American, and I guess they were uncomfortable with Aztec story from an African-American. Yeah, something to that effect. Yeah. And I guess I you got to understand, because I think we talked about not wanting to step on cultures. Like Rebecca brought that up, I think, like not wanting to do that. So I understood that and everything. In my head, I'm still like, yeah, but this is no good story. What the F, right? Finally, my dear friend, Chris Ryan, that's you, asked for a story for Soul Scream. And I said, this might be
an opportunity.
So, yeah. So I sent it. You apparently liked it. And so here we are.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there was one or two words that I requested. And it was because I was being super careful. Again, one of the functions of, I would admit, overly cautious, Stephen. You would agree? And
it's fine. That's what the editing process, what workshopping is. Well, that's the process.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to do with Soul Scream was not only celebrate, as we were discussing before, but also create a body of work that someone can read and then hand off to a niece or nephew or this or that. So the few things that I looked were just those little touches to make sure that it wouldn't slam into people. I have to tell you, I believe you serve the story. And you bringing up that a publication wanted to know your ethnicity before, and then that brings up a question that everyone deals with in a slightly different way these days. And whether you want to call them the culture police or sensitivity, Do we find that a stumbling block? Do we find that an extra challenge that we have to deal with, or a responsibility we're happy to shoulder, or a mix of the all of those?
I'd say it's a mix. Ultimately, the goal is to put out good, relatable material, right? In that struggle, you have to adapt to the times. And that's, and I think that's in like all professional, you know, all professional levels, genres, whatever. And I got to admit, yes, I was a little taken aback by when that first, or I guess I should say second publishing opportunity went away. But I also, I get it, because until we become a society that, because right now we've got folks that don't care and we've got folks that overcorrect. And right. I think what we need is for everybody to find a middle.
Yeah.
And until we do that, we're always going to end up having these conversations. We're always going to be forced to consider things you wouldn't have considered back in 1986. And that's just where we are now.
Yeah. It can be seen as evolving as a culture, and that's a good thing. But we have 35 different authors in here. Mm-hmm. And with very few exceptions, I don't think anybody handed me a story that they had actually lived. Kathleen, I hope. I really hope. Right? But Rebecca hasn't been an old folk. John didn't farm. You have not Aztec. Kathleen is here and safe, and hairs is neither of those things.
I'm hoping he's not story in that way. Crazy Alex, red hair all over the place.
Alex wrote two different stories for us. And again, we write what we know, but each one of us have written stuff that we wanted to know or that we were interested in. Mm. And I think that's maybe that's the middle. Maybe that's the middle, is that show the respect and do the work to represent mm-hmm. who you are called to write about with a sensitivity and respect. Alex?
Do your homework.
Yeah, you have to do your homework. Are there any areas that any of the writers here bump up against and or find that they resist writing about these days? Mm. Rebecca?
I don't want to say necessarily that I resist. There are definitely some things that I just don't write, but I do write outside of my culture, of my experiences, but like Alex said, I like research. So I do the research, and then that's like on the front side of things. And then on the back side, I get sensitivity readers who mm-hmm. are parts of those cultures or communities, and mm-hmm. they can make sure that I didn't screw it up. And if I did screw it up, I can fix it before I send it out into the world and look like a jerk, even out of ignorance. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, it's one more layer of running and embracing rewrite. You do the research, you do the best you can, you hand it over to someone who would know, and they check. And it's what is for culture, it is for lifestyle, but I also find it in professions as well. I wrote a supernatural police procedural and handed it off to a police cop friend of mine who kicked my ass for quite a while. But it's the same kind of thing. If we can do it for that, if we can, you just, it's all about getting it right. Alex, let's hand it over to you for a while and see what, I see him with the deep thoughts. And by the way, Alex is usually at least sharing the wheel. So I'm just so curious to see what he has to say or ask. Alex Simmons.
A couple of quick things. One is, in terms of what we're talking about at this moment, we are recipients of a legacy, a sort of skewered, biased legacy, that's part of why we have to deal with this for a couple of hundred years or more. The writers who were getting published were of one particular culture, race, whatever, and could write about, as far as they were concerned, any other culture, any other mm-hmm. lifestyle, any other person, and mm-hmm. be damned information. There was no need to represent respectfully anything. It was just going to be what it's going to be. And if we take it even to the point of acting, because we talked about different professions, I've done major dialogues on the fact that when Universal Pictures and another company were doing a slew of Charlie Chan films, that for 45 years, Charlie Chan was never played by an Asian actor. All right. It's always a white man in makeup.
Yeah.
Native Americans, for the most part, throughout a lot of early Hollywood's life, were played by Italians, Greeks, and other, but not Native Americans. Mm-hmm. So we had that huge pendulum stuck at that end. And as it started to swing, and fairly recently, we're talking about late 60s, early 70s, it's starting to swing. Representation of women. One of my favorite jokes with my offsprings, I can't call them children anymore, is we used to watch these old serials from the 40s. And sometimes the women would get pushed, fall and hit their head on a pillow and get knocked out. Because they had to get the women out of the way so the men could do the fighting. I'm thinking, oh, God, help me. And we're sitting there going, this is sad. So I think what we're dealing with now is recognizing, okay, that was messed up.
Yeah.
Here we are. We have a different sensibility. We are going to try and do our homework. And we also have to deal with a lot of reactions of people who, A, want to hold on to that, or the other side of it, and Chris's face this, where people of a different culture are saying, no one but us should be writing about us. And that makes it another problem, because at least I feel my people have gone through a large period of time of trying to just get into the ballpark so that we can play.
Mm-hmm.
And all we want to do is play the game, do it right, have a good time. But if we're relegated to only what the culture can do, the work on the culture, then that means we can only write about us. So we can't write about anybody else. Men can't write about women. Women can't write about men. And forget cartoon animals, because I've written about a cartoon dog and I've never been one. So literally we start the game.
Well,
there's
a couple of nights.
Damn it, I'm going to tell you that right now. So the reality here is, I think what we're dealing with is what I said earlier and what Rebecca also echoed. You do your homework. You try and be respectful of the culture or the individual or the lifestyle or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Once you've written it, you pass it on to people who understand that, live that, are that. So you get and be open to their feedback, constructive feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if it's important to you to do the work right, then you'll hear them. You'll go back in. You'll adjust it. And no, it will never be as if you've lived that, right, but you will give a respectful representation thereof. And I think that's where we are. And everything that I've heard today are people who are passionate and enjoy what they do. And you've come to that respectfully. And I just get the feeling that this is the type of writing circle that I would want to be a part of.
Yeah, you are.
Oh, thank you.
I had asked for as many female protagonists as possible. And I was quiet about it because I didn't want it to be perceived as jumping on that bandwagon or being feminist. It was because of Pat Savage, who is Doc Savage's cousin. And whenever she showed up in a story, I had a much better time. She was just a great character. And I wanted to see if we could get a lot of great female characters without making a fuss. I just wanted to, organically as I could, see if that could happen. And throughout all five of these, without an agenda, there's just a richness of great characters in here, whether Aztec or old or the daughter of a farmer or a roommate. Both of those characters, Kathleen, are fascinating. Or Mary Day, which Alex wrote about. Excuse me for a minute. Oh, sorry.
Okay, do it again.
I was all episode, I was fighting whether I was going to have to sneeze, and I thought I'd be able to make it, but no.
Bless you, by the way.
I got it.
Oh, yeah,
Alex,
there you go.
Ask a question.
Okay. I'm curious. Actually, a good question, because we're all coming on towards the end of this. I would love to know from each of you, starting with Rebecca, What have you got in the works now? What are you aiming towards, going after, developing, whatever? So starting with Rebecca.
So I got a lot of plates in the air. Forgive the plug, okay? It's my first book. In Memory of Exoskeletons, which is a dark poetry collection, just came out in March. So I'm still trying to do some promotion with that. And I have another book coming out in 2024 that is called Self-Made Monsters. That's going to be hybrid, so feminist horror, fiction, and poetry. I've got another project I'm working on that is not announced yet, but will be soon. That's super exciting. And,
well,
and
if you want to.
Chris, I'm going to let you do that then. I'm going to hand it over to Chris, but I'm really excited about it.
I love the titles of the first two that you mentioned. I really do. Great titles.
Rebecca's going to be able to announce another title because really a very short time ago, Rebecca posted something on social media and it hit me like a bolt, and I wrote a message to her and I said, you have a book in there. And that started a conversation. So Rebecca I have shelves and shelves of how-to and writer's books and these learned people, Robert McKay, Joe R. Lansdale, all these about how to do this. And it's all from this very established, learned point of view. And I was really looking for bare bones as you're making it how to, while it's still fresh in your mind. And Rebecca is writing How to Get Into Horror. And what is the title there, Rebecca?
Okay, it's a title and a subtitle, and we're not quite sure the number yet. I'm going to say a number, but it could and it probably will grow. It is called Creep This Way, How to Become a Horror Writer with 20 Plus Tips to Get You Ghouling, yep. Written by Rebecca Cuthbert and edited by Christopher Ryan.
Yes. Yeah. And from
ghouling. Okay.
From my rough estimate, that number is going to be way higher than 20. And then we're going to switch sides, and Rebecca is going to edit my writing on a project that Alex has known about for a long time. And that is, I forgot what we called the title, but it's about 138 character bio questions.
There you go.
There'll be a series of small books. Rebecca's is pretty thorough, but I'm going to do a couple of slim volumes and just things to help
develop character.
Newer writers,
yeah.
Not necessarily young writers, just to ease their way into writing. Okay. So
I'm going to jump back to the other folks just because, again, yes. I'm clock watching. So
let's go.
So Rebecca, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. John.
What have I got going on? I have probably a dozen short stories in the hopper that I'm trying to get published right now. Another dozen are past halfway towards being what I would consider publishable. So I'm really focused on short fiction, honing the craft, trying to get into new markets and grow my audience. I just had my 7th short story of the year appear at Crystal Lake Publishing Shallow Waters.
Nice.
It's a really mean and gruesome body horror piece called Hammered Halloween, about a down-to-earth, a working-class hero, alcoholic dad trying to do right by his daughter on Halloween. Yeah. And things, as so often in my stories, go sideways. But I'm really focusing on short fiction submitting to magazines, submitting to anthologies, trying to build an audience, find my audience, and hone my voice and craft.
So. Excellent.
Cool beans. Thank you. I like the dozens thing. He keeps doing the dozens. It's a dozen that. Okay.
It's a lot. I write a lot of short stories.
The 12 thing.
For a Pushcart prize. So I just want to give a shout out there.
Both Rebecca and John got nominated for Pushcarts. So very cool.
Hot dog. Okay. Kathleen?
Let's see. I finished revisions on my middle grade novel, The Rats of New York, and my agent just sent that out to publishers yesterday.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Great.
Success, you can do body horror for a middle grade, but this is cool.
It's more like it's garbage horror.
Oh, okay.
But it was super fun to write and really freeing, just like writing about animals with human traits. And then I'm working on revisions right now for a novel on a haunted quilt. So I'm close to finishing that. I have glimmers right now of a novel I want to write with heavy metal as the setting. Love that scene. And I think it's ripe for horror and body horror. Yeah.
Cool. In your volume, check out Randy Dawn's story.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really cool. All right. Anything else, Kathleen? That's enough.
Isn't that enough?
That's beautiful. It's beautiful. Yes. All right. That takes us to SVP, Stephen Van Patten.
All right. Like I said, I just released that anthology, SVP's Little Black Book of Terror. Next year, I plan to at least put out Brookwater's Curse 4, maybe Killer Genius 3. I have to figure out where we are with the third installment of our A Hell at the Various Locations series. Right now, I'm doing something completely non-horror related, working on a piece about Jim Thorpe, the athlete from 1912 who won the medals, and then the medals were stripped because he apparently played baseball and got paid or something to that effect. That'll appear as an animated piece on a YouTube channel called Extra Credit. Normally, I do some spooky stuff. That's how they had me working with them in the first place. And then George Floyd got murdered. So then they started asking me to do Black history. And I did about 13 episodes of those. And I think we just decided to pivot to Jim Thorpe. And it's actually a pretty fascinating topic. He led a very compelling life. Yeah, so that's all that's new with me right now.
Excellent. I'm sorry. It's got to be more. It's got to be.
I got to sleep at some point.
Oh, that's all right. Okay. I'll give you a pass on that one.
He's got a pretty demanding day job. So this is all on top of all of that. So SVP for president. There you go. All right.
Thank you.
He goes, I pass. That's a terrible job.
No, I wouldn't want to do that. Plus all the stuff I did in my 20s would come out. That wouldn't be good.
Yeah. So I'm thinking here that
it's time for the final question. No, go ahead.
So I'm thinking one of the last things we like to do is to give our guests an opportunity to share one last bit of wisdom or thoughts or whatever. So once again, let's go around, starting with Rebecca again.
My advice is to have fun with it because nothing else is guaranteed. The publications, the money, the book sales, the reviews, the awards, none of that is completely within your control. So you just have to like what you do and have a good time.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
Excellent.
Thank you. Next, John.
Johnny G.
I would say try to go out and as a new burgeoning writer, you got to find your people to share your work with. Mm-hmm. It can be hard to put stories out into the world that you feel like you've poured your soul into, and finding some people that you can share them with that are going to be friendly critics and help. That's a really key first step to making your stories better. Finding a community to share wins and losses with, but it's a doorway into the horror community, which for me, the last couple of years has been fantastic. But you got to step outside of the bedroom, the office, get away from the keyboard and go meet people that will actually help you become a better writer.
Excellent.
That's good advice. I'll try to take it.
Yeah. Kathleen.
The lines of John, just be curious, seek out new experiences. Take the subway, people watch. They're so weird. Wow. Write everything down.
Okay. Thank you.
That's really cool.
Steven?
And it's funny because my first thought was to say something along the lines of what John and Kathleen have said. but I will also throw this in. Check your ego at the door.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Just be open to learning, to the criticism, to other people's viewpoints. Because again, it's great if you can tell a story or if you think you can tell a story, but sometimes other people know how to make your story relatable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just for the fun of it, Chris.
It's building on what Steven said is I always try and avoid when talking about editing having to fix or what's wrong with the story. I try to phrase it as opportunities, chances to polish, because we get so focused, and this is from 30 years of being a teacher, among other things. They think that if they're not right the first time, then they're wrong. And that's not this, that's not how writing works. That's not how art works. So I try to avoid those kind of words that have these negative weights to them, and try and substitute, just trying to seduce writers to embrace rewriting, because that's really a big key to writing, is to be willing to go back and massage it. You know, we're much more oil painters than we are watercolor. We go in and work it. And that's how I, that's what I would end. Alex?
Yes. Yeah. I'll guess.
You're not getting away.
Oh, look at the time. I would also add to that, the thing that I like to say to my writing students is, don't judge an idea the moment you have it. It's saying, oh, the baby doesn't walk, throw it back. The idea of it, the purpose of an idea is to be that, to be this flash of a thought, jot it down, keep it. Maybe you go back to it an hour or so later, maybe you go back to it weeks later, but keep it. Don't judge it and invalidate it the moment you have it, because a lot of emerging writers do that. Oh, that's probably stupid, or probably nobody will be interested. No, you have the idea, jot it down, step back from it, and then later explore it and nurture it and see where it takes you.
I believe you got to take those ideas shopping, or take them to a party, or go for a walk with them. And if they're still with you when you come back, then there, maybe you got to work with them for a while and see where they go. But if they fade and they don't, then they weren't meant to be written anyway. But yeah.
That's what he said.
That's what I said.
That's what he said, right?
I'd like to thank everybody for being here today, because you donated a lot of your time, and you really helped make Soul Scream, for me, a just really satisfying experience.
Dare I say a screaming success?
We're working on it. We're working on it. It is selling. Various volumes are going here and there, but we're going to try and push and get the word out a little more. But the first thing was to see if it made it work. And then I got fascinated with where we could go. And that's all of you. And I thank you very much for that.
Yes, great. Thank you for coming on the show. Oh, look at that. Look
at that.
Wow.
That's why they call him legend. Look at him.
I thank you all for coming on the show. And please know that we will be inviting you back individually, as a group, however that works, because there's so much more I know that you could share, not only with Chris and I, but with our listeners. So please expect to hear from us again. But thank you for being with us today. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Chris, as always, it's been an experience. Peace. I'm not quite sure what to do with it, but we'll figure something out. Okay.
Yeah.
Take care, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye. Bye.